You're listening to Guts and Glory, the SGH Gastroenterology Podcast. Good afternoon and welcome to the Guts and Glory Singapore General Hospital Gastroenterology Podcast. I'm Dylan.
I'm Ching Han.
And I'm Andrew.
And we are your hosts for this podcast. So what the Guts and Glory is that we hope to bring you guys the latest in cases, updates, as well as discussion in gastroenterology and hepatology that you can tune into anytime, any place, and anywhere.
So I had a few colleagues who were asking me about why we decided to do a podcast. So I think COVID has disrupted a lot of things in our lives. And one of those is the way we teach our students and our learners. And despite the difficulties, we have to adjust to the situation and leverage on some of the options we have. Podcasts are a great resource. I mean, I'm a podcast geek myself. I subscribe to tens of podcasts daily, ranging from basketball, religion, education, medicine. And it's one of those rare things that we can do while we are doing other things like showering, exercising. So we decided to do a podcast mainly to target learners in medical schools and IM residents in general, because I believe that some of the content will be beneficial for them. So we hope to make this topic of gastroenterology and hepatology accessible to the masses. And of course, to stimulate people to consider us one day as a career option.
To start us off with this program, we're going to be starting with the topic of cirrhosis, one of the big core topics in gastroenterology and hepatology. And with us today, we have Prof. Jason Chang. He is a senior consultant gastroenterologist from Singapore General Hospital. He's also the head of department for the Singapore General Hospital Gastroenterology Department.
Okay, hi. Hello, everyone. Thanks for introducing me. So I will say firstly that I love my life as a gastroenterologist. In medical school, actually, I started out wanting to do A&E. And that's because in A&E at the time, that's where all the action was, right? As a medical student, we don't really see much action until we did A&E. But then I realized that I didn't really have the satisfaction of getting to know patients and managing them over a period of time and seeing them get well. So I moved on. And as a first year MO, I was posted to cardiothoracic surgery. And I love cardiothoracic surgery. I love managing this CSICU. I love participating in, you know, open heart surgeries. And I thought, you know, that I would be good as a surgeon. But then I realized I didn't enjoy the work-life balance of a surgeon, and I cherished the diagnostic challenge of internal medicine. And my next posting was gastro. And to me, gastro really provides the best of everything. There is the diagnostic challenge of solving patients' problems. There's the satisfaction of building relationships with my chronic patients. There's the satisfaction of doing procedures and, you know, stopping the patient's bleeding. And there's also the occasional rush of what I call the hero moment. So the hero moment is that moment where, you know, everyone in the room knows that the patient is bleeding, but they turn to you and you are the one everyone turns to solve the problem. So to me, basically, gastro has a mix of all worlds. It is all at once interesting, it's challenging, and it's very fulfilling. One piece of advice I would give to listeners is that you should aim to work among friends, not just colleagues. So this is a goal I constantly strive to work on to ensure that I'm always surrounded by my friends, even in my workplace. Because when you have friends who can understand what you're going through, who can support you when you most need them, and whom you will willingly support when you know they need you, then work is never a burden. So that's my mantra in life.
Let me just share a bit. I think for all our guests, it would be nice for me to just give everyone a perspective of what they are like in the working environment that we are in. So Jason has, throughout my training, has been my overlord, even now as a faculty. So what I mean is that when I was in the department as a medical officer, it must be 13, 14 years ago, Jason was the guy who was in charge of MOs at that time. All right? And then when I became a senior resident, he was the program director. And when I became an associate consultant, he was the head of department. So even now in MedACP, we're working together as in faculty development. I'm the deputy director, he's the director. So in every step of my life, he is my overlord. It's just the gap is ever getting closer, but it's still a gap. One of the interesting things is for me to share a bit of a special power of all these colleagues that I have. So Jason's special power is his organization skills. So if you have worked with him, and you have sat in a cirrhosis clinic with him, you realize that he is a very organized person. He even came up with this 2-page document for every cirrhotic patient that when they get clocked in to the clinic for the first time, you actually have to fill up that when was the last OGD they had, the size of the varices, what's their child score in this day, what was their HCC surveillance like on this day. So every patient would have this page right in front of them to tell you exactly where they are in terms of their cirrhosis management. So I think that's a testament to his organizational skills. And I think it's very important in the topic of cirrhosis because you're dealing with so many different complications for all these chronic patients. So I'll pass the time back now to Dylan. Ching-Han, you can introduce the case perhaps.
Okay, so I think before we go straight into the case, cirrhosis is a very, very big and complicated topic. So maybe Prof. Jason, do you have sort of a short introduction on cirrhosis or something that you want to share with the listeners?
Okay. I guess we want to firstly talk about the fact that, you know, liver cirrhosis is a condition which is a chronic condition. So it's important to correctly identify these patients and manage them well, because we don't, what happens basically is they will deteriorate and they will eventually die, right? So I think that makes liver cirrhosis something that's important for all of us to know. With regards to, you know, the epidemiology of cirrhosis in Singapore, we published a study in SMJ in 2015, and hepatitis B is the most common etiology of liver cirrhosis, about 63%, followed by alcohol at 11%, and non-alcoholic fatty liver disease at about 9%. The other etiologies like hep C, autoimmune hepatitis, and PBC are less common, about 5% and all that. But over the recent decades, I think importantly, fatty liver is beginning to overtake hepatitis B to become the most common cause of liver cirrhosis that we are seeing now in our clinics. So I think this is important for all the listeners to know that as we are able to vaccinate against hep B, as we are able to treat hep B very well with antiviral medications, the number of hep B patients progressing to cirrhosis is getting less and less. But on the flip side, the number of patients with fatty liver who are developing to liver cirrhosis is getting more and more. So that's something for everyone to note.
Okay. Thank you, Prof. Jason. Cirrhosis is a chronic condition that probably most of us will need to encounter sometime during our clinical work. So we will aim to discuss a few aspects of cirrhosis in this podcast. So we have Mr. L. He is a 57-year-old Chinese male who presents to the emergency department with discomfort from abdominal bloating and lower limb swelling. Initial labs reveal a hemoglobin of 11.2, a platelet count of 98, AST of 82, ALT 76, bilirubin of 36, and albumin of 28. Would you like to share with us, you know, what are some features in the history of physical examination that we should look out for, and how would you start to approach the case?
Okay, so if you look at the clinical history, I guess this patient is presenting with new onset of ascites and lower limb edema. And if you look at the information provided to us, he has biochemical features that would suggest liver cirrhosis. And I say this because his platelet count is low. He has abnormal liver function tests with ASD higher than ALT. His bilirubin is a little bit high and his albumin is low as well. So taken all together, I would this strongly suggest a patient who has liver cirrhosis. So how would I proceed? In all patients with liver cirrhosis, what I would suggest is look at three things, right? Number one, what is the etiology of liver cirrhosis? Number two, what is the severity of liver cirrhosis? And number three, what are the complications of liver cirrhosis that are present in this patient? So when we talk about etiology of liver cirrhosis, we therefore need to know what are the common etiologies in our population. So the most common, as mentioned, is hepatitis B, right? So in the approach to this patient, you want to know, is this patient a hepatitis B carrier? Does this patient have a family history of hepatitis B? Has he been previously vaccinated to hepatitis B? Second most common is alcoholic liver disease. So you want to take a good alcohol history to find out if he's at risk of this. And number three is NASH. So does he have metabolic syndrome, diabetes, obesity that would predispose him to have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease? Other conditions are things like hepatitis C, autoimmune hepatitis, and rarely Wilson's disease, especially if it's a very young patient with cirrhosis. For severity of cirrhosis, you want to know, is it compensated or decompensated? You want to assess his child score, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. And importantly also, you want to assess whether this patient has complications of liver cirrhosis. So here, this patient's presenting with ascites. That's a complication. You want to know, does he have a hepatic flap? You want to know whether he has a splenomegaly, for example, or potentially an irregular liver to suggest HCC. So these are the ways I would sort of approach this patient.
Okay, so we have gone through a few aspects of the history as well as physical examination. Following this, what sort of investigations should we arrange for that will help us in determining the severity of the cirrhosis as well as complications?
Regarding physical examination, I just want to add that in most patients with cirrhosis, when you examine them, the most common sort of features that most cirrhotic has are things like spider nevi, gynecomastia. In later phases of the disease, these patients will have what we call complications. So they may have ascites, splenomegaly, which you can and should, you know, examine for when you see these patients. You must always examine for whether the patient's jaundice, whether the patient has a hepatic flap, right? And in patients who have features of liver cirrhosis and portal hypertension, but paradoxically have a large liver, especially if it's very irregular, that would make you wonder whether there is a HCC or hepatoma present. So that's with regards to physical examination. To your question about investigations, as what we would normally do in these patients, of course, first off, a liver function test to look for those abnormalities has already been shown. A full blood count to see if the patient has a low hemoglobin because he may have bled from a variceal bleed, for example. You expect his platelets to be low because of portal hypertension and hypersplenism. Other tests that we would usually do would be investigations to evaluate the etiology of this patient's liver cirrhosis. So, for example, if you are suspecting hepatitis B, for example, you want to run the hepatitis B markers to look for evidence of chronic hepatitis B, so the HBs antigen and HBs antibody. Same thing for hepatitis C, you want to run off a hepatitis C screen. For patients who may have autoimmune hepatitis or PBC, you want to do anti-liver antibodies. For alcohol and fatty liver, basically, those are determined by the history rather than a specific blood test. But one of the important test investigations to do that helps you diagnose liver cirrhosis would be an ultrasound of the abdomen, specifically looking at ultrasound of the liver. So the radiological features that tell you that this patient has liver cirrhosis would be coarse aqueous of the liver, as well as surface nodularity, which means an irregular margin of the liver. Sometimes you may also find that the volume of the liver is reduced, and that are very clear cut features of cirrhosis on ultrasound. On ultrasound, you can also look for features of portal hypertension, and these include things like splenomegaly, ascites, the presence of varices. Sometimes you will see what is termed as recanalization of the umbilical vein, and that basically is a sign of underlying portal hypertension. And lastly, on the ultrasound, you want to look for complications of liver cirrhosis, specifically things like liver cancer or portal vein thrombosis. So that would be what you would look out for on the ultrasound for this patient.
Thanks so much for sharing that. I think it's very useful to know what are the specific features that we look out for, especially on ultrasound, since it's such a common investigation that, you know, we order for many of our patients that come in with abnormal liver function tests or presentation that's suspecting of cirrhosis. Prof, if I may ask, you know, how do we select patients for, you know, elastography or even for like a hepatic portal vein gradient?
Okay, so that's a great question. I think for listeners out there who may not be familiar with what elastography is. So liver elastography is an investigation which is based on the elasticity of the liver. So an ultrasound, for example, basically helps you to image the liver. So you can see nodularity of the surface. You can see a space-occupying lesion liver. You can see the spleen. You can see how big the liver is. But an ultrasound does not tell you how stiff or how hard the liver is. So it can't tell you, well, how bad, you know, whether this patient has early cirrhosis or very advanced cirrhosis. So liver elastography, or we call transient elastography of the liver, which is done through a machine called a FibroScan. It's a scan, very much like an ultrasound scan. It has a probe which you put on the surface of the liver. But what it does is that it measures how stiff or how hard the liver is. And obviously, the more cirrhotic the liver, the higher the value will be. So the higher the stiffness of the value. So to answer your question, when would you do a FibroScan or elastography of the liver? Basically, I do it in basically two situations, I guess. The first situation is when you are not sure the patient has cirrhosis and you're trying to rule in cirrhosis, especially very early cirrhosis. These are patients who may have, let's say, low platelet, for example, and on the imaging, there's just a bit of coarse echogenicity, but otherwise there are no other features to conclusively tell you that this patient's liver cirrhosis. So often, basically in the past, to solve the problem, we would have to do a liver biopsy, right, in order to know for sure whether this patient had cirrhosis or not. This is usually in a situation where the patient's cirrhosis is still very early. So this patient has not gone on to develop ascites or, you know, splenomegaly yet, although the patient may already be histologically cirrhotic. So in these situations, if you suspect cirrhosis, your ultrasound can't really confirm it. That's where you want to do an elastography, because if the elastography is completely normal, then this patient doesn't have cirrhosis. But if the elastography shows that the stiffness of the liver is elevated, especially if it's elevated beyond 13 kilopascals, which is the cirrhotic range, that helps you to now rule in that this patient likely has early cirrhosis. The other situation where elastography may be helpful is basically to prognosticate the severity of cirrhosis. For example, let's say we know this patient already has cirrhosis, but I want also to know, well, does this guy have early cirrhosis? Does he have cirrhosis with what we call clinically significant portal hypertension? Because if he has clinically significant portal hypertension, then his risk of developing varices, bleeding varices, ascites, HCC and all is going to be higher. So doing a FibroScan will be able to help to tell you, because if this person's FibroScan is in a cirrhosis range, but just, you know, very, very low in the cirrhosis range, and this patient doesn't have clinically significant portal hypertension yet. So this is a value of 13 and above. But if this patient has a FibroScan value of greater than 21 kilopascals, then it's likely that this patient has clinically significant portal hypertension. So that's to answer your question about elastography or FibroScan. Your other question was about HVPG, which is hepatic venous pressure gradient measurement, right? So for that, that is a bit more invasive procedure, because we basically need to put in a catheter through the internal jugular vein down into the hepatic vein. And we do that to measure portal hypertension, to know exactly how high the patient's portal pressure is, usually in a situation where there is clinically significant portal hypertension with the presence of enlarged varices. And we want to prognosticate what is the likelihood that this patient's varices are going to bleed. The second situation we would use a HVPG is when we treat patients with beta blockers, for example, to lower portal pressure to reduce the risk of bleeding varices. So for us to be accurate in our treatment, we would want to measure the pressure before we start treatment, measure the pressure again after we start treatment to show that the portal pressure has reduced. So those are some of the situations we'll do HVPG.
To summarize what we've gone through so far, we've talked about the history as well as physical examination to focus on for patients with cirrhosis. And really the focus is really on the etiology, severity, as well as the complications that some of these patients may have. Some of the investigations that we went through talk about identifying the underlying etiology, especially in Singapore, whether it's hepatitis B, alcohol, or non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. And we've also talked about the indications of when to do elastography, as well as hepatic portal venous pressure. To move on with our case, you know, with some of these above investigations, Mr. L is revealed to have Child's B cirrhosis secondary to chronic hepatitis B. Autoimmune and metabolic screens otherwise return negative. Mr. L is otherwise concerned about his condition and what his prognosis is. So when facing patients like Mr. L, you know, what are some of the complications that we counsel them on?
So some of the common complications that can develop with liver cirrhosis, especially with, you know, progressively severe liver cirrhosis, will be like what Mr. L has. So we counsel them on the possibility of developing ascites, and there will be accumulation of fluid in the abdomen or in the legs. And that is basically occurs as a result of the high portal pressures, as well as the low albumin level as a result of the liver cirrhosis. And so as part of the counseling, we do tell them the importance of maintaining a low salt diet, because in patients with cirrhosis, the consumption of salt leads to accumulation of free water in the body, and that worsens the ascites and the low limb edema. So the first step of management in such patients to prevent or delay the onset of ascites, often to treat ascites, is a low salt diet. So sometimes we would refer this our patients to the dietitian who can help them, to empower them to watch the diet and to know which foods basically are low in salt. The second treatment that we give for patients with ascites is diuretics, usually spironolactone with or without furosemide. And this basically get the kidney to work to help to offload some of the additional water that is accumulated in the body. The other complications that patients may have are the development of varices, which are swollen veins in the esophagus. And these occur because the liver is hardened and therefore blood cannot flow through the liver back to the heart from the gut. And so what happens is that the blood therefore, you know, takes a detour and flows through these blood vessels in the stomach and the esophagus. And as a result, these veins in the esophagus can become engorged, they can get swollen, and they can rupture. When that happens, the patient will have hemathemesis, which is vomiting of blood, or they may have melena, which is the passage of very black, sticky stools. So what we counsel the patients that if they observe vomiting of blood or they notice black, sticky stools, that is a sign of internal bleeding. In those situations, they will need to come to the A&E immediately, right, for emergency endoscopy treatment. Of course, part of what we do to prevent that from happening is to send them for a gastroscopy to screen for these varices. And if varices are present, that's where we will do a HVPG measurement to measure the pressure, therefore telling us, giving us a prognostication of the likelihood of a varicose bleeding. And then we will start these patients on medication, non-selective beta blockers like propranolol or carvedilol. And what these medications do is they help to reduce the pressure in the liver to prevent rupture of these varices. The third thing we tell patients about in terms of counseling with regards to complications is the importance of surveillance for liver cancer. So all our patients with liver cirrhosis are placed on a liver cancer surveillance program. This is a 6-monthly ultrasound and alpha fetoprotein tests are done. And this is basically to monitor for the growth of any liver cancer. So what we tell patients is because they have liver cirrhosis, they are at risk of liver cancer. We can't prevent liver cancer from developing, but we can certainly diagnose liver cancer at an early stage. And if we can do that, then we can potentially treat their liver cancer and even potentially cure them of their liver cancer. So those are three important things that we'll counsel Mr. L on.
So Jason, just want to ask you about cirrhotic patients, right? Because you mentioned bleeding in a cirrhotic patient. So there's this confusion that some people have because is a cirrhotic patient coagulopathic or are they thrombotic? Because on one hand, they tend to present with all this bleeding, purpura, and we're concerned about that. Their PT is elevated. But yet, at the same time, they develop portal vein thrombosis. So how do we actually reconcile the two?
Okay, that's a great question. So the true answer to that question is they are neither coagulopathic nor are they thrombotic. Or you could say they are both coagulopathic and thrombotic at the same time. Now, what do we mean by this? We start with this misconception that most of us have since medical school. And that misconception is that patients who have liver cirrhosis are prone to bleeding, i.e. they're coagulopathic. And why do we say this? We say this because of two things. One, we say this because, oh, his platelets are low. And we know that if you have low platelets, therefore, then, you know, when there's any, you know, mucosal bleeding, it takes longer for the bleeding to stop. The second is that we are told in patients who have liver cirrhosis, their prothrombin time becomes prolonged. And a prolonged PT, again, is a marker of coagulopathy, meaning that this patient is more likely to bleed, or this patient's, if the patient should bleed, it takes longer for the patient to clot. So because we look at these two parameters, we say patients are at risk of cirrhosis, are at risk of bleeding. But that's actually not true because there are other parameters which we don't normally assess in patients. So for example, we don't assess the thrombophilic markers, the protein C, protein S, antithrombin 3. These are proteins which are made by the liver and their function basically is to break down clots. And you'll find that in patients with liver cirrhosis, their levels of antithrombin 3, protein C, protein S are actually very low as well. So in a sense, basically, they are also thrombophilic. That means they are pro-thrombotic, right? So on one hand, they are, you know, anticoagulated. On the other hand, they're also pro-thrombotic. And so the actual truth is that both anticoagulant factors and pro-thrombotic factors are made by the liver. And when the liver is cirrhotic and not functioning well, both of these basically are low. On top of that, patients with liver cirrhosis are specifically prone to portal vein thrombosis, but not venous thrombosis elsewhere. So they're not more prone to DVT, they're not more prone to cerebral venous thrombosis, but they are more prone to portal vein thrombosis. And the reason they're more prone to portal vein thrombosis is nothing to do with their coagulation profile, but it's to do with the fact that because of Virchow's triad, as you know, Virchow's triad is hypercoagulability, is endothelial dysfunction, as well as resistance to flow or slow flow. So in patients with liver cirrhosis, the main problem is that there is actually resistance to flow, right? Because of the hard liver and in the portal vein, basically the blood cannot flow well. And as a result, that predisposes them to portal vein thrombosis, together with the fact that a lot of them also has endothelial dysfunction as well. So to answer your question, patients with liver cirrhosis are not specifically coagulopathic unless they are in the late phase of liver failure when, you know, their INR is 2, 2.5, 3. You know, in those situations, the liver is completely failed. Then yes, in those situations, it's akin to a patient with DIVC. They tend to be oozy all over, right? But in the early phase of liver cirrhosis, they are equally coagulopathic and thrombotic at the same time.
So thanks for that, Jason. I think that was very helpful for, I think, for people who may not be used to managing patients with cirrhosis. Now, cirrhosis can be a scary topic for some. I think partially because of the innumerable number of complications that you can get from cirrhosis. Now, I just want to ask you, as a hepatologist, as someone who has managed so many cirrhotic patients, which is the complication that scares you the most? Because we actually want to have multiple sessions covering cirrhosis, just the nature of the topic is huge. But which are the complications that when you look at your patient list and then you see them coming in with that and you take a deep breath, you know, and say, okay, this is going to be tough. Which is the one?
So I think, you know, the one that is most, how to say, challenging, the one that invokes a tachycardia, right? That invokes the most visceral response is going to be, you know, massive hematemesis in a patient with liver cirrhosis. So variceal bleeding is always a challenge because it presents as an emergency and it's potentially life-threatening if you don't manage those patients optimally. So I think to me, that remains the most challenging complication of liver cirrhosis.
Thank you, Prof. Jason, for sharing all the complications of cirrhosis with us. So actually, everything sounds pretty scary to someone who has liver cirrhosis. So to Mr. L, who's concerned about his prognosis, how would we actually explain this to him? And what are some factors that we use to prognosticate a patient with cirrhosis?
Okay, thanks. So we go back to Mr. L's condition. I guess for Mr. L, he's a patient who does have liver cirrhosis. It's due to his hepatitis B. And his cirrhosis is at least, I mean, I would consider it moderate because he's already Child's B in the sense that he's now presented with decompensation, which is the ascites. But having said that, I mean, his overall, you know, overall sort of scheme of things, his liver cirrhosis is still, you know, fairly in the early phase. And there are many things that we can do to treat the patient and actually return him to a fairly sort of normal sort of quality of life. So the first thing basically in patients with liver cirrhosis is to understand if there's an underlying etiology that is causing the cirrhosis. So here is he has hepatitis B, and the hepatitis B is causing inflammation of the liver that causes progressive scarring of the liver. And if you don't treat that, if you don't stop the damage from hepatitis B, then obviously his liver cirrhosis will get worse. But if we have an opportunity to reverse the etiology, so in this case, we would treat his hepatitis B with anti-hep B medications. Right, and the hepatitis B medications we have nowadays are very effective to control hepatitis B. And if a patient cirrhosis is, you know, not too far progressive, in some situations the patient's cirrhosis actually stops there, and you know, may even get a little bit better. The second thing for Mr. L is that he has ascites, and therefore we will treat his ascites with a combination of low salt diet as well as diuretics. And so when he takes his diuretics, he will find that his ascites will get better. And that would, you know, should, in a sense, reassure him, right, that this condition is treatable. Now, having said that, there are other complications we need to watch out for down the road. And one of the ways to sort of reassure the patient and to manage them well is to prepare them for all the potential things that may come and to help them to understand what we can do to help to prevent this from happening. So we talk about variceal bleeding, you know, for the patient to come in, you know, vomiting blood, that's very, very sort of, you know, stressful to the patient and the family. And so if we can get the patient to understand that and to participate in a screening, gastroscopy, HVT measurement, treatment with non-selective beta blockers in order to prevent variceal bleeding, that strategy has been shown to halve the risk of variceal bleed in such patients. So that part's important. The other part that's also very important, which we haven't touched on very much, is the complication of hepatic encephalopathy. So this is a condition where patients with cirrhosis will suddenly become confused, drowsy and confused because you know toxins that are usually cleared by the liver now basically escape and get to the brain and cause some cerebral edema. So it's important when we manage these patients to counsel the family beforehand that such a thing may happen. Because the first time it happens, it can be very scary to the family because the patient will be suddenly, you know, talking nonsense, you know, being very, very confused. And so they get very worried. They're worried that the patient is demented, senile, or had a stroke or something like that. So if they can understand that this is due to, you know, the toxic effects due to liver cirrhosis. And usually these patients, once you treat them and you remove the toxins, you know, they go back to normal within 24, 48 hours, right? So that part makes it helpful. So these are the things basically that we would use to counsel the patients. With regard to prognostication of the patients, I guess the most useful prognosticating system is the Child-Pugh score. And the Child-Pugh score consists of the bilirubin, the albumin, protrombin time, and presence of ascites and encephalopathy. So if the child A, they're considered compensated cirrhosis early with a very good survival of 10 to 20 years. If they're child B, then we consider already decompensated cirrhosis. I would guess, you know, they call them moderately severe. In those patients, their survival can be about 5 to 10 years. And if they have child C, liver cirrhosis, then these decompensated patients have severe liver cirrhosis or advanced liver cirrhosis. And their prognosis is generally less than 5 years, about 2 to 5 years.
Thanks so much, Prof. So, you know, with this second part of the case vignette, we've gone through, you know, what are some of the complications that we counsel our patients from the common complications such as ascites, hepatic encephalopathy, variceal bleeding, and even hepatocellular carcinoma. We've also talked about how we can advise our patients to anticipate or look out for some of these complications as well.
Thanks, Dylan. I mean, that was quite a comprehensive coverage by Jason on cirrhosis. I think we will dedicate quite a few episodes to cover the different aspects of cirrhosis, just by the sheer fact that it is such a huge topic. I think we'd like to draw the attention of our listeners as well to, there's a recent publication in The Lancet, which is a review article on cirrhosis, a nicely written article that is not too advanced. I think even for medical students, it's a nice read. So we'll include the link to that in our show notes. And I mean, we really like to thank Jason. This is our inaugural episode of our Guts and Glory. I think it was something that we've wanted to do for a while. And I think it's a great resource, hopefully, for medical students and residents alike. So like what Jason said, you know, I think working in an environment where you have people who are friends, I think that's very important. So one of the challenges is to actually get guests, which it's not that difficult for us, to be honest, because everyone is a friend in some way in a department, and just asking around for people to come to be a guest was a fun endeavor on its own. So any parting words you'd like to tell your listeners, Jason?
Yeah, well, firstly, you know, thanks for having me on. It's great to be a guest on this inaugural podcast, you know, and, you know, thanks so much to Dylan and Ching Han for hosting me. I guess just last two things I just want to say as parting words. The first is a conversation that I just had with, you know, one of the medical students and a similar conversation with one of the residents. And the question was, you know, it's very common that patients who have liver cirrhosis will have portal vein thrombosis. And if they have portal vein thrombosis, their portal pressure will increase and therefore they are at risk of varices, right? So they would have varices. So in such situations, would you treat these patients with anticoagulation in order to remove or treat the portal vein thrombosis? And most of, well, all my students or residents say, no, you know, I wouldn't give anticoagulation to this patient. And when I ask them why, they always say, well, basically because the patient has varices. And just like you said, you know, he has a risk of bleeding varices. So the last thing you want to do is to put him on anticoagulation. So my question in those situations is, if you put a patient who has, you know, liver cirrhosis, portal hypertension, and varices, if you put a patient on anticoagulation, would you increase his or her risk of bleeding? And the real answer is no, it doesn't. Putting a patient, whether the varix bleeds or not, is not dependent on how anticoagulated the patient is. The varix will bleed because of the pressure, of the portal pressure. Once the portal pressure is high enough, it will cause a rupture of the varix, and that's why the patient bleeds. So putting the patient on anticoagulation will not increase his risk of bleeding. If he does bleed, however, it will make the bleeding more severe because, you know, it will prolong the clotting. And so in the normal patient, the patient may stop bleeding by themselves, but in this patient, the patient will continue to bleed. So the key in patients with portal vein thrombosis is that you have to reduce the thrombosis, because if you don't solve the thrombosis, the pressure will be high and the patient will be more likely to bleed. So your anticoagulation therefore helps actually to reduce the risk of bleeding, because as you clear the thrombus, the portal pressure will drop and the risk of variceal bleeding will drop. So that is something that we will now need to sort of, you know, get accustomed to, because now it's actually proven, there are a lot of studies that have been done to prove this, right? That in patients with portal vein thrombosis and varices, anticoagulation is not contraindicated. In fact, it actually reduces the risk of bleeding. So I just want to put that out because that is a common question I've asked. The last thing I just want to say for this podcast is we're talking about liver cirrhosis, is that in the past, 10, 20 years ago, when we managed patients with liver cirrhosis, we used to tell them that, yeah, this is a, you know, chronic condition, incurable. There's nothing much, you know, we can do to help you except to manage the complications. In this day and age, it's not true, because cirrhosis is potentially curable, and that is via a liver transplant. And that concept has to be brought up early for a patient with liver cirrhosis to understand that this is not a condition that I'm condemned to die off, that there is potentially a cure for this condition, and that cure involves a liver transplant. So I think it's part of our understanding of the condition of liver cirrhosis is to understand that, you know, these patients, the best thing you can do for them is to transplant them. And that's all I have. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much once again, Prof, for your thorough approach to patients with cirrhosis. To our audience, thank you for tuning in to today's episode, and stay tuned as we go through more about the management of cirrhosis as well as some of its complications in future episodes. Until then, we've been The Guts and Glory, and we hope to see you next time.